Imagine waking up in this completely strange bed, being handed a frilly pink satin dress by a matronly talking bear, and then realizing you have to serve breakfast to a queen. And you're secretly operating as a spy.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're reading a totally whimsical fairy tale.
Exactly. Okay. But today, for you listening at home, we are diving into a world where the actual laws of physics are tied to a massive constitutional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to save the planet is to literally hack the universe's source code. Welcome to Mirari, which is this magical realm currently trapped in a deadly, endless winter.
It is just a phenomenal premise. Today's deep dive takes you into this really fascinating set of narrative logs. They detail the political intrigue, the hidden identities, and the super rigid magical rules governing this kingdom.
Yeah.
The excerpt we're exploring today follows a young girl named Alice, who is, you know, navigating this really high-stakes royal court entirely in disguise.
Right. So our mission today is to kind of unpack this really complex fantasy world for you. We are going to do code, the fierce political battles over a missing king, reveal a shocking emotional secret at the heart of the royal family, and explore what happens when the immutable rules of a universe are suddenly pushed to their absolute breaking point.
It's a lot to cover.
It totally is. So let's unpack this. We start with Alice's morning. She wakes up in the servant's bedroom at the Palace of All Seasons, and her alarm clock is Beatrice, who is a bear maid wearing a black dress and a white apron embroidered with roses.
Yeah, Beatrice is this wonderful contradiction. Like, she looks like she could easily catch a salmon out of a river with her bare paws.
Oh, absolutely.
But she is incredibly gentle, you know, cooing at Alice to wake up and get dressed for her duties. Beatrice mentions that Alice has the look of April about her, which is a comment Alice just casually brushes off as she assumes her alias, which is Lady Jill.
Right, she's Lady Jill now. So she grabs a quick breakfast in the kitchen, which, by the way, sounds amazing. They have these sweet breads glazed with honey and red berries decorated like rose vines.
Makes you hungry just reading it.
I know. And then she heads straight into the Queen's audience chamber to serve as a lady-in-waiting. It totally reminds me of like a kid pulling off an undercover boss stunt.
Yeah.
In like a high-stakes corporate boardroom, you know. She's in this pink dress, trying to remember to curtsy and wash behind her ears while actively gathering high-level intel.
Well, the camouflage of servitude is incredibly effective here. I mean, by leaning into the persona of Lady Jill, this slightly naive, super enthusiastic girl from the provinces, Alice renders herself virtually invisible.
Yeah, they don't even see her.
Exactly. To the power players in the room, they just see what they expect to see, right? A pretty child serving breakfast. They do not see the observer who is cataloging their every move. And what she observes is this masterclass in the mundane, just coexisting with the surreal.
Right, because you have these cuckoo clocks ticking alongside, like fae servants who can miraculously clean up a spilled glass of apple juice in literally seconds.
And leave the carpet completely dry.
Yeah, it's wild. Meanwhile, the other ladies in waiting are just casually gossiping. But they aren't gossiping about, you know, normal teenage stuff. They're debating the lore of ancient heroes.
Like Lord Bram and Lady Angelique?
Yeah, Lady Angelique using a magic mirror to reflect a dragon's breath. And Alice accidentally drops that she actually met a living dragon named Lord Monitor, which completely short-circuits the older girl's brains.
Right, because that's not in their official storybooks. That moment perfectly highlights Alice's totally unique position in this world. She has direct, practical experience with the magical realities of Mirari.
Right, having spoken face-to-face with a dragon.
Exactly. While the nobles of the court, they only know these entities as dusty legends or, like, ghost stories. It establishes really early on that Alice is not constrained by the same dogmas that completely blind the rest of the court.
And I just love the humor in her internal monologue during all of this, too. Like, she realizes she can't quite remember what the plan is from her handler.
Yeah, she just wings it.
Right. She just decides the best way to handle plans is just to play along. But Alice's invisibility as a servant is exactly what gives her a front row seat to the real issue. Because while she's, you know, pouring drinks and playing along, the adults in the room are facing a literal crisis of physics.
Yeah, it gets heavy very fast.
The court is completely paralyzed by a constitutional crisis that is quite literally freezing the world.
The whimsy just evaporates the moment the doors open. Queen Seraph is holding court, and the stakes could not be higher. Lord November arrives first, and he brings a glimmer of hope, right?
Yeah.
He warns of dark hands at work, but announces that a hero named Lord Explorer Thomas has returned from the wild lands.
Which Alice secretly knows is her friend Tommy. Like, she has to bite her lip to keep from cheering out loud right there in the throne room.
It's a great moment. But that brief moment of hope is instantly shattered when the queen's brother, Lord April, enters with his page, Simon.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Lord April and Queen Seraph immediately engage in this incredibly fierce relationship-shattering argument. The core of their conflict revolves around the missing monarch, King Mark, who vanished on December 14th.
And here's where it gets really interesting for you listeners. In this world, there is a magical law called the Rule of Merari. And the rule dictates that a king rules for exactly 1 year.
With a capital Y.
Right, a capital Y year. When a new king ascends, it brings spring. But because King Mark is missing and hasn't officially passed the throne, winter is just going on forever. The peasants are starving. The fields are buried in snow. So Lord April demands to be made king immediately to save the land.
Yeah, he's very aggressive about it.
Super aggressive. But the queen completely refuses. She insists her husband is alive and that she cannot legally or morally usurp him.
Right. And to understand the queen's refusal, we really have to look at the mechanics of this universe. The Rule of Merari is not, you know, a piece of legislation passed by a parliament.
It's not a suggestion.
Exactly. It is the structural fabric of reality. In a Merari, the monarch doesn't just rule the land politically. They are biologically and magically tethered to the planet's actual cycles.
Wow.
Yeah. The energy required to shift the hemisphere from winter to spring isn't solar. It's drawn directly from the life force of the reigning king. To pass into history at the end of a year means the king literally dies. His life is the ignition switch for the new season.
Okay, I have to push back here, though. Let me play devil's advocate for Lord April for a second.
Okay.
Think about it from the perspective of the people living in this world. Isn't Lord April actually right? Yes, he's aggressive. He's clearly terrifying his sister. But people are literally freezing and starving to death. If this rule of succession acts like a magical term limit where the outgoing leader literally has to die to change the seasons, shouldn't they bend the rules to save the population? Like, why is the queen clinging to parliamentary procedure when the world is ending?
Well, from a purely utilitarian standpoint, Lord April's argument is formidable. I mean, the needs of the many starving citizens should theoretically outweigh the traditions of the royal family. Lord April himself actually asks the queen, "Who are we to cling to the rule of law, to insist on a tradition that consumes us alive?"
Right. That makes perfect sense.
It does. But Queen Seraph understands the terrifying mechanics behind the magic that Lord April is choosing to ignore. To usurp a living king has literally never been done. There is zero precedent for it.
Uh-huh.
She fears that breaking a foundational rule of Merari might trigger a consequence far, far worse than an endless winter.
Oh, so it's not just her being stubborn or, you know, holding on to power. It's a genuine fear of breaking the universe. She's terrified that if they crown a new king while the old one lives, the magical equivalent of gravity might just turn off.
Precisely. If the king's life is the anchor for the turning of the world, having two anchors or forcefully snapping the tether of the first one could unravel their reality entirely. Lord April views the rule as an obstacle. Queen Seraph views it as a load-bearing pillar of the universe.
Oh, that's tense.
So when she refuses him, he storms out absolutely furious, leaving the queen just devastated.
And so she dismisses the court, but Alice stays behind. And this transition brings us to the real emotional epicenter of our deep dive.
It really does.
The queen retreats to her private sitting room, which is decorated with this super intricate ocean theme, like mermaid statues holding glowing pearls, tapestries of catfish that literally look like cats with fins. It's a deeply personal, intimate space, away from all the prying eyes of the lords.
Yeah, the contrast is stark.
And Alice approaches her, not as a servant, but to offer genuine comfort.
And here, the political facade completely drops. The queen embraces this little servant girl, begins weeping, and calls her Angel.
This is the massive reveal of the narrative. Alice, the little girl pretending to be Lady Jill the servant, is actually Princess Angel, the queen's own daughter.
It's such a shock.
I really want you, the listener, to put yourself in Alice's shoes for a second. We find out that Alice was secretly sent away to live in the mortal realm, in a place called Annington, with a normal family called the Westfields, for her own safety. Imagine finding out that your entirely normal childhood, where your annoying brother Gabriel teased you, where you went to music class and learned to play the flute, was actually a magical witness protection program designed to save you from political assassins.
I mean, the psychological toll of that realization is staggering. Alice believed she was just a normal suburban child. Discovering that her life was a fabricated safe house forces her to completely recontextualize her own identity.
You thought she was just an observer.
Exactly. She wasn't just observing strangers in that throne room. She was watching her mother and her uncle tear their family and their whole world apart. And the narrative logs detail exactly why this extreme witness protection was so necessary.
Right. Because of her older brother, Prince Richard.
Yes. Prince Richard was killed in a highly suspicious jousting accident. The Queen and the Lord Protector strongly suspected it was orchestrated by subtle, unseen enemies within the court who were maneuvering for power.
Just awful.
But beyond the threat of assassination, there was a second, even more horrifying reason they exiled their own daughter.
Goes right back to that terrible rule of Merari.
Because a monarch's reign inevitably ends in their death at the turning of the year, the Queen and King faced a horrific dilemma. If anything happened to King Mark, Alice would be next in line.
Right.
They could not bear the thought of their young daughter ascending the throne, only to serve as a temporary human sacrifice to keep the seasons turning. They sent her away to spare her life from the very magic that sustains their world.
It's completely heartbreaking. They loved her so much, they exiled her to a different dimension. So what does this all mean for Alice as a character? How does growing up, playing in a normal suburban neighborhood rather than a magical palace, give her an edge over these ancient, powerful lords?
Well, it provides her with a profound outsider's empathy. The Lords of Merari, like Lord April, they are deeply entrenched in the system. They view the endless winter and the brutal sacrifice of kings as terrible, perhaps, but ultimately as the unchangeable physics of their reality.
Like, it's just the way things are.
Exactly. It is all they have ever known. Alice, however, grew up in a world where seasons change naturally, driven by planetary orbits, not human blood.
Right.
She knows a different reality is possible. She isn't constrained by the dogma of Merari because she simply wasn't indoctrinated by it.
She knows that power transitions don't require human sacrifice in Aemington, which perfectly sets up her next move. Now that Alice understands her true identity and the horrifying reality of these rules, she absolutely refuses to just sit on the sidelines and watch her family suffer. She decides she needs to change the story to secure a happy ending.
Yeah, she transitions from a passive observer to an active, super calculated strategist. We see this shift in the intelligence report she disguises as a letter to her mortal realm friends, Namui, Tommy, Agatha, and Rachel. She is officially operating as a spy behind enemy lines.
She warns them about Lord April, noting he might not even be who he says he is. She speculates he could be a shapeshifter, or even the dreaded warlock known as the Destroyer.
Who might actually be Lord Eon of January?
Right, she's putting all the pieces together, sharing the lore of the 12 houses, like the April Cat and the October Crow, and warning her friends that the political infighting inside the palace is just as dangerous as the endless snow outside of it.
But the most critical piece of intelligence she uncovers and shares is a prophecy from Lady Raven.
Ooh.
It's a prophecy that King Mark received right before he vanished into the snow. It states, "Anything can be broken, then forged anew. Rules can be changed by those with the mind to."
I got so excited reading this part. Think about it like the fundamental source code, or, you know, the terms of service of a massive multiplayer video game.
Yeah.
Everyone else in Merari, Lord April, the Queen, the ladies awaiting, they're all just trying to figure out how to win the game within the existing rules.
Right. They're playing by the book.
Exactly. They're arguing over who gets the crown and how to force the season to change based on the code as it is written. But Alice isn't trying to win the game. She's realizing she can literally jailbreak the universe. She wants to go into the source code and delete the line that requires kings to die.
Which is wild. And the implications of that are terrifying for the inhabitants of Merari. The existential dread at the heart of this deep dive is what happens when you alter that source code.
Yeah.
The Queen warned earlier that the rules are the very fabric of Merari. If you jailbreak reality, you might crash the entire system. Like, if you remove the sacrifice of the king, what powers the spring? Does time stop completely? Does the world simply dissolve into chaos?
It's a massive paradigm shift. She's not just a hidden princess trying to reclaim her throne. She's an architect trying to rebuild the foundation of her world without knowing if the new foundation will hold.
However, the prophecy implies that the system is not as immutable as the lords believe. If rules can be changed, it suggests that the magic of Merari is responsive to intention, to willpower by those with the mind, too.
I love that.
Yeah. Alice is betting that her desire for a happy ending, her fundamental belief that people shouldn't have to die for the snow to melt, is a force powerful enough to rewrite that source code safely.
She approaches it with such innocence, but it's actually the most radical concept imaginable in this world. She tells her friends to seek a happy ending. In Merari, where the official stories always end in sacrifice and passing into history, a truly happy ending without a body count is a complete rebellion.
The narrative beautifully weaves the micro and the macro here. Alice's intensely personal desire to save her father from the winter and comfort her grieving mother scales up into a quest to fundamentally alter the cosmology and physics of her entire universe.
So let's bring all these threads together for you. We've journeyed from a whimsical disguise as a lady-in-waiting, dealing with talking bears and fae servants, right into a bitter, gridlocked political battle over an endless winter.
It's been a ride.
We've uncovered the tragic emotional secret of a hidden princess placed in magical witness protection to save her from her own destiny. And finally, we've arrived at a bold, universe-altering plan to rewrite the laws of reality itself.
It is a remarkable progression. It really shows how an outsider's perspective can identify the flaws in a system that insiders accept as inevitable.
And why does this matter to you? Why should you care about Alice and her magical kingdom? Because Alice's story is an incredibly powerful reminder about the systems we all live within. When a system is fundamentally broken, whether that's a toxic workplace culture you feel trapped in, an outdated family tradition that causes pain, or a societal rule that demands too much sacrifice, you don't have to just accept it as the way things are.
Absolutely.
You don't have to just play the game by the rules you inherited. Sometimes the rules themselves need to be questioned, challenged, and completely rewritten from the ground up.
It requires immense courage to look at an immutable law and ask, why does it have to be this way? It takes the perspective of an outsider to realize that just because something has always been done a certain way doesn't mean it must continue that way. Alice's empathy, born from her time in a normal world, is her greatest weapon against a stagnant, deadly system.
Which leaves us with a lingering thought for you to ponder long after we wrap up today. Alice and her friends are setting out to break the most sacred rule of Merari to save the king and end the winter. They are trying to jailbreak reality to save the people they love. But if you successfully shatter the foundational laws that hold your universe together to get your happy ending, do you risk becoming the very destroyer you were trying to stop in the first place? Think about that the next time you decide to break the rules.